All right, well, once again, my name's Sam. I turned 50 last year. Maybe that's another thing you need to know. So I've hit the midway mark of life, and I can't believe how quickly it's gone. So that's something I've noticed. Another thing I noticed was a few years ago, some friends of mine said, hey, U2 has come into town, the rock band U2. Let's get some tickets. Let's go see U2. And I said, yeah, let's go see U2. So we go to U2, and I'm like, yeah, this is me, I'm young, I'm hip, I've still got, you know, rock and roll. Then after a while, I looked around and I realised, everyone around here looks really, really old. This is not a young person's concert, U2, this is an old person's concert. Everyone had, you know, the high dad jeans. They're still dancing with their hands like we did in the 80s. It's all in their hands. They had no hair on top. I thought, oh my gosh, this is an old person's gig. And then I'm looking at my watch. I'm thinking, it's pretty late. Like, it's a school day tomorrow. Like, come on, wrap it up. Wrap it up. And finally at 10 o'clock when they play their last song, I thought, oh, at least we get to go home at a decent hour. And then people around me started yelling, more, more. I'm like, no, 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 we got to get home. And they kept yelling, more, more, more. And then the band came back on. I thought, oh, see what you've done. Now we're going to be really late. But that night showed me, wow, something has changed. I'm an old person. The people around me are old. And U2 is an old person's band. When you listen to Triple J, they're not playing U2. We talk to young people about U2. They do not know who you're talking about. You think you're being edgy, contemporary and cool. You're just showing how old you are. And what I'm trying to show you is the music we used to listen to is not what they're listening to now. And maybe the forms of evangelism we used to do may not be what's working so well now. Because who we used to be are not who the people are now. So I'm asking today, at least for the next two or three sessions, that we can be open-minded. Pretend we're missionaries coming to a new culture, a post-reach, post-Christian culture, and do what missionaries would do. Like, how can I reach this culture for Christ, like as a blank slate? Maybe that's one thing to have in our mind. Another thing I want us to think about is this. Evangelism requires a lifestyle change. And I was saying this on Saturday. Every New Year's, we make the same New Year's resolution. This year, I'm going to get fit. I'm going to get fit. So come January, we all get out there at 5 in the morning and we do our morning run. We sign up for the gym. We change our diet. We think, this year I'm going to get fit. And it only lasts 1 or 2 months. Because, as I say with fitness, it can't be something we tack onto our life. Our whole lifestyle has to change. It has to become a fit lifestyle. We don't tack fitness on. The lifestyle has to become fit. And typically we approach evangelism as, oh, I've got to tell my friends about Jesus. I've got to tell my friends about Jesus. As something we tack onto our lifestyle. Okay, I've got to get brave enough to tell my friend about Jesus at lunchtime. Oh, I've got to sign up for a cooking class and I can meet non-Christians. So we're trying to tack evangelism onto our lifestyle. But as I argued on Saturday, that is important, that is necessary, but it's not enough. It actually requires a lifestyle change. Our lives have to become evangelistic. And we looked at that on Saturday. But what I'm also going to argue for today, which I didn't argue for on Saturday, is church needs to become evangelistic. And that's what we're looking at this 1 hour session. So typically in churches, we've approached evangelism as event-based things. So we often criticize the church. Oh, you guys aren't being evangelistic. Why don't you put on something? Invite a guest speaker, have a guest service, maybe have a men's breakfast or a beer night or a women's fellowship night, which is evangelistic. And those things are important. We need to do them, but they're event-based evangelism that we tack onto our church calendar, and in some ways it's unsustainable, and in some ways it's not enough. Just like fitness, church needs to become evangelistic. It's not enough to do evangelism as an event. We actually have to become evangelistic. And that's what we're going to look at today. And I'm going to share from you the where I get this from in the Bible. Then I'm going to look at the concept, then I'm going to look at the reality, then I'm going to look at three tips from me, and then you guys are going to generate your own tips. So we'll begin from the Bible. Where do I get this from in the Bible? Then we'll look at the concept of church being evangelistic. Then we'll look at the reality of church being evangelistic. And then I'll try to share with you three tips. Tip one, tip two, and tip three. And then you guys are going to try to workshop and see what tips you can come up with for making your own church become more evangelistic. So let's begin with the Bible. What is the church's role in becoming evangelistic? Well, typically the church has two roles. So let's say this is the church. And I'm so sorry that the whiteboard is off to the side. This is an Anglican church, isn't it? Like a Chinese church would never do it this way. But somehow an Anglican church has to have everything off-center and just askew. All right. Now, no one's laughing, so I've obviously misread the audience here, haven't I? Rule one, know your audience. So either everyone here is Anglican or they're too afraid to laugh at the Anglicans because they're so serious, aren't they? They can't laugh at themselves, so maybe we're not allowed to laugh at them. All right, so... But they would put a whiteboard off to the side, wouldn't they? All right, so... As a church... We have a missional task. We're meant to go. We're meant to go. And we can easily come up with Bible verses for that. Like Matthew 28, the Great Commission. Go, make disciples. Or Jesus in Acts 1 to his disciples. You be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the ends of the earth. So therefore, go, go. There's a missional task for the church. But I would also say, and secondly, there's an attractional task of the church. We go, but as well as going, we also attract. And the Old Testament anticipates this in Isaiah chapter 2. And I'll just read Isaiah 2, starting verse 2. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. People will come and say, hey, come. Let's go to the mountain of the Lord. Let's go to the temple of the God of Jacob. So the Old Testament looks forward to this day when the nations, the Gentiles, the pagans will say, hey, let's come. Let's check out this temple of God. And then it's fulfilled in 1 Corinthians 14 where Paul has his vision of church. And this is in 1 Corinthians 14 where he says, you've got to do things in an orderly way. You've got to prophesy the gospel. Why? Well, for this reason, because it's your task. Because when the unbeliever or the inquirer or the seeker comes in, while everyone is prophesying or preaching or teaching, and then they're convicted of sin, and they're brought under judgment by all, as the secrets of their hearts are laid bare, they will fall down and worship God, exclaiming, God is really among you. So somehow Paul has this idea in the Bible that we're preaching to a mixed audience. So that's number one, the Bible. Let's go to the concept now. The concept is we have a mixed audience at church. At any one given time on a Friday, Wednesday or Sunday, we actually have two audiences. We have believers who turn up to be fed and edified, but we also have non-believers who are turning up to check us out. Calvin actually had this idea because he talks about the universal invisible church, which was all the believers, all the saints. But he also had this idea of the visible local church, which was mixed, which had some saints but some non-believers, some pagans. So that means the reality is, on any given Friday, Wednesday or Sunday, we have two audiences, believers who turn up to be fed, but non-believers who are checking us out. So church automatically can't be evangelistic in that sense, in that we always have an audience of non-believers checking us out. So that's the Bible, that's a concept, that we have a mixed audience. There will always be non-believers out there checking us out. And let's go to the reality of what really is happening in our churches. And I'll just shorten it on a Sunday. So let's say on a given Sunday when we run church, what's happening is this. Now, most of you know this, but once upon a time, when Billy Graham comes out here in the 1950s, he preaches the gospel in a 20-minute message, and people pray the prayer, they tick the box, they come forward, so they believe, and then they come to the front, and then we plug them into a church. So, hey, you live in this area, you should go to the church in this area. So, they find a belonging of Christians. And as you know now, in the 21st century, it works the other way around. People, before they believe, actually walk into your church on a Sunday. And they'll actually be there for years. And bit by bit, they'll drift into belief. So belonging comes before belief. And so the church actually has probably the major role in evangelism rather than Billy Graham or someone like me giving the 20-minute Bible talk, the church actually does the 2 years lead-up work that leads to me coming in, being the cherry on the top of the pudding, giving a 20-minute gospel talk, and then they believe. But it actually requires the church having done 2 years of lead-up work. On Saturday, I shared with you something exciting that's happening in our life. We run a play group, and we have a lot of non-believers turning up to our Tuesday morning play group at our church. Most are non-believers. Bit by bit, the non-believers are starting to come to church on a Sunday, and they've been coming for 1 or 2 years. And 1 or 2 of them now have actually believed and been baptized. There's one lady we're praying for and talking with. She came to a church Sunday guest service for the last 2 Sundays in a row. She's heard me preach the gospel explicitly 2 Sundays in a row, 2 20-minute gospel messages. But for that to have happened, we found out what's happened in her life. As a kid, her parents sent her to Sunday school. And then she went to a youth group to the age of 16. And then she walked away from the church. She probably never was a believer in Sunday school or youth group. Then she, a few years ago, not in our play group, went to the church play group run by someone else many years ago. And then she got invited to these guest services by my wife, Steph. So she started coming to these guest services because her kids go to the same school as our school. And she walks in, she goes, I remember this church. I came here for play group. So somehow it's needed a lot of little things happening, Sunday school, youth group, play group, now coming to church. And now she says, I want to come to church. I want to come to church. I don't care what my husband says. I'm going to come to church. So in this church, on any given Sunday, will be her. Another lady has been now come for 2 years. She's on the morning tea roster, but she's not a believer. There's another guy who came and heard me speak 3 years ago, who's been coming ever since. Still not a believer, but he's on a set-up roster. So that means in our church will be non-believers on rosters who feel so much of a belonging, they actually put themselves on a roster, but they're not believers yet. So that's the reality. Whether we like it or not, we have a mixed audience on any given Sunday, believers and non-believers. And I think the church has the major role in evangelism, not the speaker who comes and gives a 20-minute talk. For that to work, the church has had done 2, maybe 20 years of lead-up work for that moment to happen. All right, so I'm going to suggest 3 tips now on how we can make church more evangelistic. And maybe these are familiar to you, but maybe they're not familiar for maybe half of us. Number one is what Tim Keller calls evangelistic worship. So Tim Keller has a term for this, and it's evangelistic worship. So Tim Keller says, typically we have this dilemma. How do we design our church services on a Sunday? We can either go seeker-sensitive, borrowing a US term, where we preach the gospel to the non-believers, hoping for a response. But now the problem is the believers feel, wow, that was just a bit light this Sunday. I didn't feel fed. I felt patronized. I felt like I was talked to like a Sunday school kid. All right, so then we can go the other way around. We can run, for the want of a better term, maybe edification type Sunday services where we use the Bible, we encourage, we edify, we preach application to the believers. But now the turner-uppers, the non-believers, just find that too inaccessible. It's too dry, it was long, it was boring. So Tim Keller's suggestion is this third position called evangelistic worship, where we preach the gospel in everything. So it comes out in the whole service, and that becomes the basis for the way we edify the believers. So instead of, which we don't do anyway, but instead of preaching law and application, doing and don't do to the believers, we preach them the gospel and then use that as the basis for what they do and don't do. So instead of telling husbands, be faithful to your wives, don't cheat on them, instead we tell them about Jesus, who gave their lives for them, who purified the church, Ephesians 5, and in the same way, husbands, you need to be faithful to your wife and love her and serve her and give yourself up for her. Instead of telling Christians not to be worldly, not to be materialistic, not to hoard, be generous, be content with what God has given you, which is law, which is legalism, which is do's and don'ts, we say, We preach in Corinthians, Jesus Christ, who though is rich, became poor for our sakes. He was generous to us. Oh, and that's why we can now be generous to others. So we use the gospel always as a basis for the edification and the application. And if we do this, two things will happen. Number one, our believers will be edified. They will be changed. Because what changes them is not the law, not commands, not duty, not obligation. What changes them is grace. So if they keep hearing grace, our believers will be in awe of God and they will worship. Because that's what worship is, awe. Worshipping God's awe, His grace, His generosity, His Son, and will be edified and our lives will change. So Keller often says, provocatively, if someone says, oh, you know, I'm sleeping with my girlfriend, he might say, I don't think you understand the gospel. Because if you actually understand the gospel, you wouldn't be sleeping with your girlfriend. So instead of saying, don't sleep with your girlfriend, he says, I don't think you understand the gospel. See, it's a gospel that will change lives. So we want our believers to be transformed and godly, it's a gospel that will do it. And then the next thing that will happen will be this. The non-believer will be listening in. And they will actually hear the gospel, because that's all we're preaching anyway. And they will go, oh, that's why Christians do what they do. I thought it was all about not sleeping around, not sleeping with a girlfriend, no sex before marriage. Oh, it's actually about Jesus giving himself up for the church. I thought it was all about not being rich, not being worldly, being content. It's actually all about Jesus. He was rich but became poor for our sakes. Oh, that's why they do what they do. So the non-believers will hear the gospel. And so that's the happy medium, according to Tim Keller. So we run evangelistic worship. The gospel is the basis for everything we do, our singing, our praying, our preaching. That will lead to real change in our believers rather than legalism and duty and obligation. And the non-believer will actually hear the gospel anyway, and they'll actually have a full understanding of what Christianity is. It's not legalism, it's not obligation, it's actually worship of a God who sent us his son Jesus, which leads to life change. All right, so that's tip number one. Tip number two, Tim Keller calls this the McDonald's moment. So I'll write it up here, the McDonald's moment. According to Timothy Keller, there's a McDonald's moment. It's the instant the customer walks up to the counter and then the McDonald's server leans over and says, can I help you? That's the McDonald's moment. There's the interface at that moment between McDonald's and the non-McDonald's person. So for Tim Keller, what is a McDonald's moment for our church? He says it's that moment when your regular turner-upper, your believer goes, oh, I should have brought my friend today. I should have brought my friend today. I'm an idiot. I should have brought my friend today because today would have been perfect. And if you can get that McDonald's moment in your believers at church on a Sunday, they will bring their friends. See, typically what happens is this. We tell all our friends, all our believer friends, hey, bring your friends next week. We have a guest speaker. It'll be really good. And they're thinking, not if it was like today. I'm not bringing them to church. Not if it was like today. Instead, we got to run church. This is our end point. So what is our metric that we can judge a church service by? And I go to a Chinese church. And we actually sat down 5 or 10 years ago. And I sat down with a committee that designs a Sunday service. I said, for the next 2 years, we're just going to aim for one thing. We're going to aim for one thing. We're going to do everything aim for the McDonald's moment. So every person in front of us is going to sit there going, I'm an idiot. I should have brought my friend today. Why didn't I bring my friend today? And they will bring their friend next week. See, according to Timothy Keller, what happens is the chairperson, the song leader, the prayer, the preacher gets up and then they just see 100 regular faces. And they're, oh, there are no newcomers today. Okay, I'll just run it like for normal turner-uppers. And then everyone's thinking, well, I'm glad I didn't bring a friend today. Not if it was like today. So what I tell my committee to do is, if you're presiding, if you're leading singing, if you're praying, if you're doing the announcements, If you're preaching, I want you to pretend the whole front row, which is empty anyway, pretend the whole front row is full of all your non-Christian family and friends just sitting there looking at you right now, and you will lead the service in a very, very different way. It will change the words we use. It's not, we don't patronize, so but it changes the words we use. Maybe we're a little bit more explanatory, but at the same time, we're not patronizing. But I think the most important thing is it changes. There's a tone. We have a very, if you don't know it, if you've never brought a friend along, you don't know it. Maybe it's a problem. Most of us in full-time ministry have not brought a friend to church in 20 or 30 years. There's this smug tone at church. And I think it will change our tone if we imagine a row full of non-Christians in the front row. So I once got asked to speak evangelistically in a one-month series. They had me coming for 4 weeks in a row. They had advertised it for months out. So when I turned up, you know, it was a full house at all three services. They'd done their role in inviting and marketing. So it's an evangelistic guest speaker for guests. And the only thing I would say that was done for the non-believers was my 20-minute message. Everything else was cringeworthy. When the person got up to pray, it was this smug. It's almost like the Pharisee prayer. In Luke, dear God, we thank you. You know, basically we are so good and we're not like the world that has got it wrong. That's my summary of her 14-minute prayer. So one, the tone was awful. I had friends that had brought a non-Christian friend that night, and they said, oh, how about the prayer? How cringeworthy was the prayer? So they felt it because they brought a friend. So that's all I'm saying. Get your Sunday service committees, sit down and say, for the next 2 years, we're only going to aim for one thing. We're not going to aim for numbers. We're not going to aim for this. We're not going to aim for that. We're just going to aim for the McDonald's moment where everyone says, I should have brought my friend today. It would have been perfect. And it takes a lifestyle change. It actually is a paradigm shift. And it takes 2 years for the church culture to feel that change. Tip number three. And maybe there's more for the preachers, but anticipate defeated beliefs. So according to Timothy Keller right now, he did a survey, and I'm sure you've done similar surveys and then come up with similar answers. So the numbers, the top six defeated beliefs right now in the 21st century Western world are the problem of other religions. Jesus can't be the only way. All religions are the same. Same way to a different way to the same God. Number two, freedom. We have human freedom to do whatever I want, and your God seems to be taking this freedom away from me, but my freedom is absolute above this God or religion you're preaching. Number three, God's judgment or anger. How can a loving God send people to hell? Your God seems very intolerant. Shouldn't he love me for just who I am? What sort of God is this? Number four, the problem of science. Hasn't science disproved God? Number five, the problem of suffering. How can a loving God let so much bad stuff happen? And number six, the bad record of Christians. You Christians seem very unloving, very hypocritical. You've done a lot of bad stuff in your last 2,000 years. All right, so there are your defeated beliefs. So what we need to do, if we're preaching to a mixed audience, is we can't just keep preaching to the believers without imagining what the non-believers are sitting there thinking. They're thinking, oh, yeah, but. So what I want to do is thinking, what are they saying after the yeah, but? So I always imagine, when I preach, so this applies more to the preachers now. In the front row are all my non-Christian friends. As I'm speaking, What are they going? Yeah, but. So then I will address their defeated belief, because their thing could be, yeah, but what about other religions? Yeah, but. You're not saying I can't do that, are you? Yeah, but how can a loving God send people to hell? What is their yeah, but moment? So that means in my sermon, I have to address it. So what I typically do is I have two options. So in your sermon, I'm so sorry for the people over there. You have two options, and I'm sure you can come up with three, four, five other options. In a typical sermon structure, you have an intro, point one, point two, point three, conclusion. Just making it simple, that's a typical sermon structure. So I might then turn my sermon into a two-point sermon rather than a three-point sermon. And then the third point, I address the defeated belief. So at this moment I go, yeah, but you're probably thinking this. So then I address the defeated belief. Or I do my usual one, two or three points and then as an aside shoot off and do a very quick aside. Yeah, but you're probably thinking this. And that's usually how I introduce the defeated belief. So I say, you're probably thinking this. If you've been a Christian too long, you're probably not thinking this, but you should be thinking this. So affirming the right for the person to question that the yeah, but moment. So I'll give you some examples. When I was given 1 Peter 1:5-6 to preach, the main idea was, what do you do in suffering? So that was the question, and 1 Peter 5 will answer that. What do you do in suffering? So I gave them the first point, which is from the text, humble yourselves to one another. My second point was, humble yourselves to God. And then my third point was, now, you're probably thinking, yeah, but, so which one are they thinking? This one's too easy, isn't it? So then I actually speak their defeated belief. You're thinking, yeah, but why would a loving God let this suffering go on in the first place? Then I spend the third point addressing that defeated belief. Let's say I was given in my church calendar 2 Corinthians 11:1-6, all about the super apostles who come in with a false gospel and they've razzle-dazzled the Corinthians. So I set up the sermon by saying, what would cause us to leave the Jesus we once loved? Because these super apostles have come and caused these Corinthians to leave the Jesus they once knew and loved. So what would cause us to leave the Jesus we love? Well, number one, it's the packaging of this new gospel, because they've come in the form of super apostles who seem very impressive. Number two, it's the message itself of a different Jesus. The message is very attractive. So what might be a defeated belief I can address for the third point? I've been saying, Number one, yeah, the problem of other religions. Because I've basically been saying there's only one true Jesus. Don't let anyone take you away from this one true Jesus. But you'll think, yeah, but do we only need one true Jesus? Aren't all religions the same? Aren't there different ways to the same God? And then I address that one. Good. Okay. Aaron Koh from my church, who's now a missionary in Taiwan, he did 1 John 2:3, 1-11. And that's how do we know people are really Christians? So according to 1 John, we know people are Christians because one, what God has done for us, he has saved us, we are his. But two, according to 1 John, we know Christians by their love. So what's the defeated belief here? Yeah, the last one, the bad record. So now you're thinking, what about the bad record of Christians? So that's become a fun exercise for me. You don't have to do it each and every time. I'll give you another one. So I'm preaching on Luke. Jesus preaches in the synagogue. A man with demons comes into the synagogue, starts heckling Jesus. Jesus says, quiet, get out of here, and the demons leave the man. What are you thinking at this moment? Science. You go, come on. This isn't the Middle Ages. We don't believe in unicorns or leprechauns anymore. Now you want me to believe in demons. So I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. How can we believe in demons in the 21st century? So you might have a little quick aside on that. So you with me on that? So that's a fun little game to play now. So now you only need 2 points in your sermons. You don't need 3 points. And so that one time I preached, I addressed the defeater belief. Actually, in this sermon, I went full on. I had 2 defeater beliefs. One was, you know, what's the hang-up we have about truth? You know, come on. You have your truth. I have my truth. What's the big deal that there's only one true Jesus? So I addressed that. And then I addressed another one. I said, come on, why do we have to meet together as Christians anyway? I've got Jesus in my heart. I can stay at home on a Sunday morning. I can just download a sermon, worship on YouTube. What's the big deal? Whoa. After the sermon, these people come up to me. Oh, thank you for answering that. That is what my friend has been asking me all along, you know, about the one true Jesus. And then another set of parents came. Oh, that was so good. Our teenage daughter is the audience. She has been asking us that question about the why do I need to come to church on Sunday? Anyway, you've answered. If you start doing this, this is the response you will get. People come up with, thank you for answering that question. Because either my friends had it, I didn't know how to answer it, or my teenage kid has been asking me that all along and you've answered it today. And I actually really, for real, had a guy come up to me and said, oh, my brother needed to hear that today. My non-Christian brother. I so wish I brought my brother today to hear that. So you get that McDonald's moment if you start addressing defeated beliefs. Alright, so what I thought we might do now, it's your turn, because I don't know your churches. So if you've come in a church group, maybe you can get in your group of 2 or 3 in your church group. If you've come by yourself, then just try to form a group of 3 or 4, 4 at the most. I want you to workshop. What do you think are the barriers right now that you think are stopping your church from being evangelistic? And 2, what are some ways you can actually make, what solutions, concrete steps you can make to making your church become evangelistic over the next 2 years? And especially in the next 6 months in the lead up, 3 months in the lead up to the Canberra June mission. So you might have to move your chairs in circles, and we'll do this for 10 minutes and then we'll hear from each other. Alright, so we're hearing a lot of barriers and just how church is usually quite inaccessible. Just a few metaphors to think about. So one of the problems is, what is church there for? So regular turn it up is a turning up there for stability, edification, routine, tradition, comfort and rest, and maybe even some silence. And that's not a bad thing. Think in our 24-hour day, there are moments where we need that. Rituals, traditions, silence, rest, or like sleeping, eating, and routine. Those things actually sustain us, and without them, we would break, we would burn out. But at the same time, during our 24-hour day, we have to do things that stretch us, like maybe exercise. That's uncomfortable, but that makes us stronger. So actually in a 24-hour day, you need both of those in our cycle. And actually, church actually needs both. So believers turn up for stability, tradition. That's why they sit in the same chair every day. They want routine. They don't want to be disrupted. But if they can somehow understand that church exists for both for routine, tradition, rest, comfort, but at the same time, we need disruption to get stronger. Without the disruption, we won't get stronger. And the disruption comes from being evangelistic. So, you know, we have close friendships, which are cliques, and they're a good thing. That's the whole point of being a friend, that you only have a closed circle. And every time a new person comes, now you can't share intimate things with your close friend. But at the same time, to grow, we need to expand our network. So there's that tension. But if we see them as complementing rather than competing, so that's the mind shift that needs to happen at church. That becoming evangelistic is actually complementary to the rest and the routine that we have. Another one that I shared on Saturday is, do we understand church as drawbridge up or drawbridge down? So drawbridge up is church exists for the members. It's like the nations now, Europe, America and Australia having this debate. Are we for the Aussies? Are we for the immigrants? You know, do we go drawbridge down? And saying, what is church? Is it drawbridge up so we can turn on and feel safe? Or is it drawbridge down so that we can welcome the outsider? And we see it in the architecture. So 100 years ago, if you went to a post office or bank, the architecture communicated drawbridge up. Big bricks, you know, solid doors, no windows, your money and your mail is safe in here. Then it became a private business and it went glass windows embracing the street, welcoming you into the building. And our architecture, our church communicates, are we drawbridge up or drawbridge down? I once had to speak at a church on a major main road in a major city. I couldn't find the front door. Right, and obviously they had decided we're going to turn our back to the street. So that's a drawbridge up architecture, deliberate drawbridge up. So somehow our churches, but we need both, don't we? If we're only drawbridge down, we burn out. We cannot sustain, you know, just 20 newcomers every Sunday. But if we're drawbridge up, we will die. So somehow church has to be both. And I guess it's the tension I'm hearing. More things about the McDonald's moment. Somehow again understanding that everything can lead to a McDonald's moment. So once upon a time, if you had a guest speaker, and at my church we have a tradition, every February I do the guest services where you bring your non-Christian friends for all four Sundays of February. And when we first sat down 5 or 6 years ago, we stripped down the service. You know, we dumb it down. So we get rid of any cringeworthy things like announcements, the offering, the Lord's Supper, anything like that. It's all about the Word. Get it straight to the Word, you know, and strip it down, make it minimalist, nothing to confuse. But the more I've understood, I thought, no, everything in a church service is evangelistic. Because a non-Christian walk in actually doesn't understand what Christianity looks like. They don't know what it looks like. So when they hear the announcements, they go, wow, you guys bring meals to people who've just had children? Wow, you mean young people meet together safely and they have a good time, and young and people are going to meet together, like in the announcement they go, wow, I wouldn't mind this in my life. And then when you come to the prayers, they go, you can pray to this God? Because there's no other religion that prays the way we do, which assumes a personal loving relationship with a God who cares enough to answer your prayers. And the thing that blows them away is you pray for each other. So the prayers, they go, wow, I did not know. I think I want a bit of this. I want to be able to pray to this God the way you can pray to this God. And then when you take up the offering, again they go, wow, you guys are generous because a God was generous to you. And you're content with what you have. That's why you can give. I'm not very content. I wish I could give the way you people give. Suddenly everything becomes evangelistic. And then even the Lord's Supper, I think, can be done really well. Because it really communicates the gospel well. So when you can do that little spiel, every Sunday I mix it up when I used to run it and just come up with a new spiel. But one of my favourite ones is, this reminds us of Jesus used to eat with his disciples. He used to really be on earth and he ate as a human being. Then, the night before he died, he used it as a symbol of what he does for us. He dies for us in our place and washes our sins away. And he says, there will be a day he comes again, sets up a kingdom on this earth, and you can eat a meal, a real meal with Jesus. That's what we're celebrating and remembering, looking forward to today. Now, Jesus set up this meal for his followers to enjoy. So if you're a follower of Jesus, you know, we welcome you to the table. But if you're not yet a follower of Jesus, we look forward to that day when you do become a follower and you can enjoy this meal with us. And that creates that tension now. Oh, I thought I belong, but I see I'm not a believer. I'm still actually on the outside. The Lord's Supper is that moment you draw the line in the sand. Buddy, you might be on a morning tea roster, you might be on a flower roster, but you can't actually come and share this Lord's Supper with us until you become a believer. But you make it something they look forward to believe. And maybe, you know, we can re-engineer, you know, the way we do Lord's Supper as well, you know. Here, take this and be thankful, you know. And it's meant to be a metaphor for the generosity of the kingdom that God will set up, Jesus will set up when he comes on earth. So, again, it takes a paradigm shift in my church. I think it took over 2 years. And everyone has to understand what you're trying to do. The MC, the prayer, the song leader, and the preacher. Everyone has to understand. So I sometimes preach at our sister church. They still don't quite get it. So I preach at a guest service. The MC would say, oh, this is our evangelistic month where you're meant to bring a non-Christian friend. I think, this is the day your non-Christian friends are there. And then people say, are the sermons available? I go, yeah, go to the website. And I go to the website and it's listed as Outreach series, February. Everything's screaming you know, this is it's cringeworthy. They've uploaded my sermons on a site where non-Christians will go to access, and it's labeled February Outreach Series, and no one's thinking this through. You know, to the website guy. So the website guy has to know what you're thinking. And let me talk about websites. All right. Okay, let me explain. There's a difference between sender-orientated and receptor-orientated. Sender-orientated is how the information looks from our administrative point of view. Receptor-orientated is how an outsider wanders into the information. So I have three boys. They do swimming lessons one day a week. Every term, and there are four terms a year, they change instructors, change lanes, and change times. So every term, 200 parents have to go to a board. How do you think the information should be organized? This is how it's organized. You go down, oh, this is Adam. No, my kid's not in Adam's class. Okay, this is Bruce. Oh, my kid's not in Bruce's class. This is Charles. Oh, yeah. One of my kids is in Charles's class. Okay, lane 8, 3 p.m. This is Diana. Nah, my kid's not in Diane's class. This is Emily. Oh, yeah, one of my kids is there. So imagine 200 parents doing that. That is sender-orientated information. That's how it looks from their point of view. And admin, instructors. That's how it should be organized, receptor-oriented. How do I need the information to come to me? I need it with my boys' names in alphabetical order. And that's how I think church websites 99% look to me. I come and it's send-oriented. It makes perfect sense for the admin staff. And, you know, here's a test. If I come to your church, where's your address? If I have to chase down a drop-down menu or go somewhere to find your address, I'm not going to find your address. I'm not going to find it. And then if you send me a Google link, I don't trust the Google link. Google gets it wrong. It's going to send me to the wrong suburb in another country. So you have to give me, just write the name in the street corner. Give me a street corner as well, please. But that's how I want the information. Where are you and when are you? But that is like three links down here. You know, after your statement of faith, your history, or whatever. Oh, and just think about these things. And in the marketing people, I always ask them, you know, how can we get more people to come to our events? Well, he goes, what's your website look like? That's what marketers say. That's their first thing. What's your website look like? So write your website from how you want a non-believer to wander onto your website. All right, so I'll hand this back to, who's running this thing? Dave, where are you? Great.